You're waiting to be picked. You're waiting for permission to do a thing that you don't need permission to do.
That you already have all the resources to do yourself, but there is fear and there is self-doubt that says, well, you can't do this, and they must know more than you. And the more I work with these institutions, publishers, record labels, the more I see they know just as much as you. They have the same internet that you do. They can hire the same college interns that you know. And it's not this like elite class of experts anymore. Are there still good people in the publishing industry who know a ton? Absolutely. But if you're going to do that, be sure that you work with those people. The idea that the institution, the system is going to take care of you, that will cause you to starve. And you need to realize that you alone are in charge of your own success. And the deals that you make, the opportunities that you chase, all of these are moving you in the direction of that success, or they're moving you away from it.
Can you bring your best work into the world and put food on the table? I'm David Cadavy, and this is Love Your Work. I'm here to help you find the clues that will lead you to your calling. You've heard it before, the story of the starving artist. You may even believe it yourself. You may think that to keep your creative integrity, you have to give up on making money. Jeff Goins is returning to the podcast today to tell you about why that's not true at all. In fact, instead of being a starving artist, you can be a thriving artist. In this episode, you're going to learn how is it that Michelangelo was actually a multimillionaire by today's standards? How did writers like John Grisham launch their careers while having a day job? How can you get leverage with publishers, record labels, or other gatekeepers so they're chasing you instead of you chasing them? What can you do to put yourself in the thriving artist mindset? Jeff's new book is called Real Artists Don't Starve, and you can get it at cadavy.net/don't-starve. No apostrophe there, of course. So if you want to be a thriving artist, you've got to sign up for FreshBooks. FreshBooks is easy to use cloud accounting software. You can create and send professional looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. Set up online payments with just a couple of clicks so your clients can pay you easily. And if your clients are late in paying, which happens, you can set up FreshBooks so it will automatically send reminders so you can skip the awkward conversations. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to my listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/loveyourwork and enter Love Your Work in the How Did You Hear About Us section. And if you do any shipping or mailing in your business, you've got to try Send Pro from Pitney Bowes. Compare shipping rates and delivery times between USPS and other major carriers so you always get the best deal. Pitney Bowes has negotiated special rates with carriers, and they pass along the savings to you. So imagine what it would do for your business if you saved 3 cents per stamp. Visit pb.com/loveyourwork. Try it free for 90 days. After that, you're going to get Send Pro for only $5 a month. Stamps.com is $15.99 a month. Send Pro is only $5 a month. So that's 3 times the features, 1/3 the price. That's PB as in peanut butter or Pitney Bowes, pb.com/loveyourwork. And before we get to the interview, I want to thank the newest members of Love Your Work Premium, Matt Lacey, Fernando Labastida, Arif Akhtar, and Jill Fetchner will all be getting access to episodes before anyone else. Thank you for joining. Join them and see a video tour of the Love Your Work studios up on the premium page. Just go to cadavy.net/premium. And as always, thank you for the reviews. We have hit a milestone. We are now well over 100 reviews in the US iTunes store right now. And it's not too late to help. Just go to cadavy.net/review. And there are 2 new ways to listen to Love Your Work. 1, you can listen on your Amazon Echo through TuneIn. Just say your Echo's name, and I'm not going to mention it because maybe your Echo is listening right now. Then say, Play Love Your Work podcast on TuneIn. That's Play Love Your Work podcast on TuneIn. Love Your Work is also now included on Spotify. And this is a big deal because Spotify hand curates their catalog. So we made the cut. It probably helped that we were recently featured on the front page of iTunes, in case you missed that. Now, this is on mobile only. Just search for Love Your Work through the Spotify app, or visit cadavy.net/Spotify. Here's Jeff Goines. I'm here with Jeff Goines, and Jeff, you just wrote this new book, Real Artists Don't Starve, which is an amazing title and I think a great message, but I'm always curious to wonder when somebody writes a book, it's so much work. Why this particular book?
So I write books to figure things out and because I'm curious about something. And for me, this really started with this story that a friend of mine sent me about Michelangelo. And apparently in 2003, this art historian by the name of Rab Hatfield found a bunch of previously unknown and unpublished bank accounts belonging to the artist Michelangelo. And in those bank accounts were very, very large sums of money. And what Professor Hatfield discovered was that Michelangelo, when he died, had about $50 million in today's currency to his name, making him the richest artist of the Renaissance, and at that point, the richest artist who had ever come along. And what Michelangelo did, I came to find out, I was like, this is interesting. I didn't know this. A lot of people I've talked to said they didn't know this. They thought he was, you know, maybe doing okay or starving like a lot of artists that we think, you know, tend to do. And I kind of chased this a little bit further. I was able to talk to an expert on the life of Michelangelo, a Michelangelo biographer who's still living today. And he said what happened is after Michelangelo essentially broke the glass ceiling for artists in the Renaissance, he made it possible to do something that artists had never really done up to that point, which was make a good living. And in the latter part of the Renaissance after Michelangelo, many artists became wealthy as a result of his setting this example. And so I read that story, right? And then, so, you know, that's 500 years ago. And then 500 years later, I am becoming a writer and I keep bumping into other creatives, authors, artists, creative entrepreneurs, even musicians who are making a good living in some unusual ways. Like my friend who's a musician who makes $1 million a year off of sponsorships of his events, and the fine artist who is selling his artwork for less than what a lot of fine artists want to sell their paintings for, but he's just selling more of it. And he's making a lot of money through volume. And I kept bumping into these people that I now call thriving artists. And I keep running into this idea of the starving artist. So I've got Michelangelo and all the guys that followed him who are doing really well. And then I've got all these people that I know who are thriving in their art that aren't famous or rich. They're just doing well. And yet when you talk to the average person, they go, well, you can't make money off of art. And I didn't get that. And so I wrote this book because I felt like it needed to be written. We all know the story of the starving artist. What we're less familiar with is this story of the thriving artist. And I felt like this is something that's happening a lot. People are making a good living off of their creative work. This may be the best time in history to be creative, but we still tell this story of the starving artist as if it's the thing, it's the necessary fate of all creative people everywhere. And the message of Real Artists Don't Starve is that doesn't have to be true. You don't have to starve. You can thrive.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that right now is probably the best time to be an artist and at least like make a living off of being an artist, right?
So, yeah, of course.
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I wasn't alive then, but you know, when Michelangelo came along, you know, everybody was just kind of they were like tradespeople, artists were, right?
Right.
And so,
yeah,
you like maybe worked for the church and I remember there was a part in the book where Michelangelo was writing to one of his patrons and basically saying, yeah, don't call me artist Michelangelo. Call me Michelangelo. I don't know how to say his last name, but And that was kind of the setting an example and changing what that relationship was.
Yep. Yeah, he said, yeah, because they were calling him Michelangelo Sculptor. And he says, don't call me Sculptor. Call me Michelangelo Buonarroti. And he was saying, call me by my full name. And this was something that only noble men could do. Keep in mind, we didn't have last names, you know, until like a few hundred years ago. Johnson means son of John, right? Only noble people had last names. And Michelangelo grew up thinking that he was noble. And it turns out he actually wasn't. They had a surname, which was rare, but he wasn't an aristocrat. But his whole life, his dad told him, you come from noble blood. So when Michelangelo goes to be an artist, which as you mentioned was a blue-collar job, he decides he's going to – I mean he just has this mindset. Well, I have to do it as an aristocrat would do. So everywhere he goes, everything he does from how much he charges for his art to the patrons that he gets to the people that he gets to support his art, he's thinking like an aristocrat because this is his mission in life to – bring his family name back into good social standing. And so, yeah, he wrote his nephew on behalf of a patron, a priest who basically asked him to sculpt something for him. And he says, I never kept a shop like a lot of artists do. And he's using that in a very pejorative way. Like he's saying, I'm not a shopkeeper. I'm an artist and you will call me by my full name as you would address a lord. Or, you know, a cardinal or a prince. Treat me like you would treat basically your peers because I am that. And at this point, Michelangelo was in his 70s or 80s and he was rich, very, very rich. And he's saying, I'm not like all those other guys. And I think this was super interesting. In the book, I talk about the importance of mindset and really started out that way because so many creative people have a starving artist mindset. And as a result, I think they shortchange their work. If you go through life thinking you're a starving artist, artists have to starve, what inevitably is going to happen is you're going to create lackluster art and it's going to show. I mean, your attitude is going to show in your work. And we all know people like that, right? Like we all know people who say no for other people. They have this sort of defeated attitude. And before they even have a chance to succeed, they've already sabotaged themselves. And it turns out that it's possible to do the other thing, which is do what Michelangelo did and go through life with a thriving artist mindset, look for opportunities, look for ways to succeed. And it begins with thinking differently. And the book is comprised of 12 rules. And the first rule is you aren't born an artist, you become one. And that really begins with the way that you think about yourself. And if you want to be an artist, you want to be an entrepreneur, you want to go do something, it begins with this belief that you can become this different person. And before you go create great art, you first have to recreate yourself. And this is something that is kind of amazing about being a human being is we constantly have the opportunity and the privilege of getting to recreate and reimagine ourselves in different seasons of our lives. And when I was doing research for the book, I kept running into people who decided at age 30, 40, 50, and sometimes beyond, oh, I'm really an artist or I'm really a writer or I really want to start this business. And they just reimagined their lives and as a result became the artist that they wanted to be.
And with Michelangelo deciding that he wanted to get that respect, and there must have been some things that were like going on or changing politically or economically that made him recognize like, oh, I actually have the power to have this mindset. And I think today there's also things happening economically where artists are now able to be artists and make a living at it, where they have to actually recognize it and make that mindset shift in order to get into the thriving artist mindset. So because I can see how the starving artist mindset, and this is dangerous in so many different things, having the starving artist mindset can be like an identity or a point of pride thing that a person lives inside of. And then that holds them back. But at the same time, they feel good about themselves because they say to themselves, well, I'm a starving artist. You know, I'm somewhat of a martyr in some way.
Yeah.
So what are some of the ways that you can break through that?
I do think it begins with this idea that you are the sum of your thoughts. And so if you want to live a different life, if you want to be a different kind of person, you have to think differently and then act differently. I sort of follow this mantra of believe, behave, become, you know, like if you want to go be something else, I don't think you fake it till you make it, but I do think that you believe it till you become it. Michelangelo grew up with this, idea that he was a nobleman and he was pressured to be the breadwinner of the family because his elder brother was a priest, I think. And so he's going to go, you know, be a part of the church. And so now it falls on the next brother in line to take care of the family. And so when Michelangelo says, I'm going to go be an artist, his dad is disappointed because it's like saying, I'm going to go be like a carpenter. And very few men in that profession made a good living. And so Michelangelo goes into this profession that's kind of lowly with this pressure that he's got to make a living. And so he just approaches it differently. So I think in terms of reshaping your mindset, first you have to believe that you can become an artist or whatever it is that you want to be. Second, I think you need to find good teachers. So I call this the rule of apprenticeship. You need to find people who, masters really, who are willing to invest in you and follow in their footsteps. Michelangelo does this really well. In fact, he goes to one of the most fashionable and famous painters in Florence at the time, a guy named Domenico Ghirlandaio. And he goes to him and he says, hey, I'm going to be your apprentice. And he's a little bit old. He's a few years older than he should have been because you're typically supposed to enter apprenticeship like early, 11, 12. And Michelangelo goes in there about age 13, 14. And he's kind of missed his window because an apprenticeship lasts about 7 years typically. And Ghirlandaio says, no, you're too old. He goes, no, you're gonna let me in. And here's the thing. You've got to pay me. Right? Like most apprentices paid to be apprenticed. It's like, you know, sending your kid to school or something. You're paying for books or whatever. And you're paying for this opportunity to get this education so that you can go have a good career. And Ghirlandaio has this studio of artists whose parents have all paid for their young boys to be there. And Michelangelo's the only kid going, no, my dad won't let me not make money. You've got to pay me to do this. And Ghirlandaio is so taken aback and maybe a little bit impressed that he decides to take him on. He says, okay. And he brings him on and he apprentices him. And shortly after that, about a year after that, Lorenzo de' Medici comes to the studio and says, hey, I want to take two of your artists into my palace and I want to be their patron and I want to continue their education in the royal palace. The Medicis were the rulers of Florence at the time and the biggest art patrons of the age. Who do you recommend? And who would stand out to you, David? You know, all these all these kids that paid you to be there who are doing fine work. And then this one kid who was bold enough to ask, he was audacious, and you're paying him. I think there would be a little bit of a desire to get your return on investment. And what Ghirlandaio has seen, by the way, over the course of Michelangelo's apprenticeship is this tenacity, this willingness to do whatever needs to be done. And Ghirlandaio gives him access to works of art that he can copy and learn from that the other students, the other apprentices didn't have access to. He kind of becomes his favorite. By being this bold, brash kid who asks for more than, you know, really is necessary. So all that's that mindset stuff, right? Like he's going through life thinking he's special, he's different. And I think we all can do that in our own way. We can go through life not necessarily thinking that we're special, but that we're unique, that we have something to offer, and we can be looking for opportunities to succeed instead of looking for reasons to fail. I think so many people just go through life with this confirmation bias. You know, artists have to starve. Therefore, when I'm doing my most creative work, I'm chasing my passion, and I'm not making a living off of it, it becomes this badge of pride because this is what we think we're supposed to do. Well, Michelangelo didn't have any of that. He goes around thinking, no, like I'm an aristocrat. These people better treat me like one. And so he thinks like an artist. He acts like an artist. He studies the greats that have come before him. He finds somebody to apprentice under, and he's just stubborn enough to succeed.
I think that there is something to be said for kind of treating it like your job. Like there's a certain power in the phrase, it's your job or it's my job.
Yeah,
like it has like this certain assumption in that phrase, just the same way somebody might be like, they're my kids. Like, of course I love them. Or, you know, there's an assumed depth and importance to that when you say something is your job. And I think that when you are trying to do some sort of a creative craft, it's very easy to not realize that it's your job. Even if you haven't gotten to the point where you have figured out how to get paid for it, like, it is your job. You have to put yourself in that mindset. If you treat it like your job, it'll eventually become your job.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And again, that's the idea of believing and, you know, and then becoming it. I love the story of John Grisham, where he thinks maybe he'd like to be a writer someday. And he doesn't even know if he has what it takes. And I see this with people all the time. They go, oh, I want to be an artist. I want to be a musician. Well, what are you making right now? Well, I've got a job. And so what John Grisham does is he thinks he might have what it takes to be a writer, but he's not sure. So what does he do? He's a young dad. He's a brand new lawyer. So like just imagine basically the busiest person ever, right? Very demanding job. Lawyers tend to work lots of hours. You're sort of incentivized to work lots of hours. And you got young kids. So what he does is he goes to the office an hour early every day and he writes one page of a book, this story that he has in his mind, and just to see if he can do it. And he does it for 2 years and he ends up writing and publishing this book called A Time to Kill. Great book. Doesn't sell that well, published with a small publisher. He goes, well, that was fun. I'm going to do another book. Does the same thing, just a page or two a day, just plodding along. Year later, that book comes out. This time, a major publisher buys it. This book is called The Firm, becomes a mega bestseller. And he decides, okay, like now I can do this. 3 years into the process, I have what it takes. Why? Because I've been doing this for 3 years and I've got two books out. And I've actually already succeeded at this. This is very counterintuitive to this idea of quit your job, leap and the net will appear. You know, I'm pretty much opposed to this idea because not because I don't like risks, but because the right risk is always, almost always, a smaller one than we think it is. And this is boring. It's not sexy. It's not a cool story to tell the internet like, oh, it took me 3 years of getting up an hour early just to become a writer. Like, that's not cool. It's cool to quit your, you know, six-figure job and, you know, figure it out.
Go all in, you know?
Yeah, go all in. Leap and the net will appear. And it turns out this isn't the way that most creative dreams come true. I read a study not too long ago, and I talk about this in the book, of entrepreneurs. And it was done by the University of Wisconsin. And they did this 15-year-long study of thousands, I think it was 5,000 entrepreneurs. And they looked at two groups of people. One, people who quit their jobs and started a business. And then people who started a business, kept running it on the side while they stayed at their job, and then eventually quit their job. And they looked at the success rate of those two different businesses. The businesses where that were basically less risky, where the entrepreneurs built their businesses on the side and kept their jobs and eventually quit their jobs, were 33% more likely to succeed, whereas the others were much more likely to fail. And so it turns out that going all in is actually not the best way to launch a dream, doing what John Grisham did, building it slowly and gradually on the side. It still takes risk, but that's the right risk. And what I like about that is it forces you to do something today. Because we just like to fantasize about what our life might be like someday when we actually get to do the work that we feel like we're called to do, the thing that we dream of doing. And the truth is, you can do a little bit of that work today.
And you can, it feels so comfortable to live inside that of that. Yeah. Someday, you know, when I get my chance, I'm going to do this. And then you don't even realize it's too late until you're like on your deathbed, basically. But if you, if you sit and do it consistently, I love the story of John Grisham. It made me think, did you come across Anthony Trollope at all in your research as well?
No, I didn't.
Uh-huh. Oh, so one of the most prolific writers of all time worked at the post office for, I think, 33 years, wrote 47 novels and then a bunch more, and would wake up at, I think, 5 a.m. every day, 3-hour writing session before his job at the post office, even hired a guy to like come wake him up, make his coffee and stuff, and make sure that he wrote. And he had a quota, 250 words per every 15 minutes. And if he finished a novel during one of his sessions, he started the next one.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's it. I mean, T.S. Eliot was a banker and he was writing poetry, you know, while working as a banker. And actually his friends, because he was so good, his friends raised a bunch of money. They pooled all their money to like break T.S. Eliot free, break Tom free so he could go be a poet. But yeah, this is how dreams get launched. This is how great works of art get made, not by going all in, but typically building this thing slowly and gradually on the side. And sure, there are exceptions to the rule, but the rule is it takes time to build something significant.
Well, I mean, this is so, you know, right on par with your story, is that you had a job and you started writing, and then you ended up, I think, like replacing your income even before you quit your job, or maybe even increasing it. How much did your own experience tie into your desire to write this book?
Well, so it's very important to me to not write a book about my own experience, because I think those are easily dismissed, where you go, oh, that's just his experience, you know, he or she is an outlier. And I didn't want to do that. And so there's a lot of other people in the book, but there's a little bit of me, because this was my experience. And, you know, I'll tell you, David, anytime I come up with an idea or write a book or whatever, I'm thinking, first of all, does this resonate with me? Right. So I do begin with me. I start with the things that I find curious or that I don't know about. And I've always been fascinated with the relationship between art and money. And over the past several years, I've been reading a lot of biographies of artists and authors and even entrepreneurs. And I kept seeing kind of the same themes emerge over and over and over again. I was reading a biography of Michelangelo when I stumbled upon this story about him. And he's kind of the archetype that's, you know, woven throughout the book, as you know. And so when I was reading this and I was thinking about my own experiences, I was like, there's resonance here. And the thing that I have in common with these stories from 100, 200, 300, 400 years ago are also the same things that are seeing in my peers. So maybe there's something here more than just a good idea. Maybe there's something here more than just one person's experience. Maybe these are principles. Maybe these are timeless truths and strategies for how creative people have always succeeded. And so I wrote the book to say, yep, these things are true for me. These things are true for Jim Henson and Michelangelo and Twyla Tharp, for multiple mediums and different eras. Like, these things, it seems, have been always true. And they can be true for you as well. So yeah, I do always start with me, because I don't like reading books where it's clear that the author is very, very far removed from their subject matter. I interviewed an author one time about marketing who was a business professor. And I asked this person, are you following the rules in the book about marketing to market your book? And the person responded, well, you know, we change the color of the book from black to orange because blah, 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 blah. And I was like, what? Like, no, the answer is no. Like, you wrote a book about marketing. but you're not following the rules in the book to market your book. And I never want to do that. I never want to be so far removed from the subject matter that I haven't first lived it. But I'd experienced a lot of this stuff. And at the same time, it was important to me that this was true for other people. And I just found it proven true over and over again, story after story, interview after interview. These are the things that I think creative people everywhere throughout time have always done to succeed. And if you do these things, you are much more likely to succeed. And if you don't, you're basically rolling the dice. You know, you're hoping that you get lucky. And I don't think success is a crapshoot. I think that you follow time-tested principles. And sure, luck may contribute to some of it, but not all or most of it. Most of it is hard work and it's being strategic, making the right choices. And the more of the right choices and the fewer of the wrong choices you make, the better off you're going to be.
We're going to take a quick break. If you're a freelancer or you run a small business, you know it's important to get paid. And the more painless you can make it to get paid, the more you can concentrate on your craft. There's really no better system out there for getting yourself paid than FreshBooks. It's like mission control for everything about getting paid. Besides beautiful invoice templates, FreshBooks has time tracking. It will also automatically pull in your bank account data and categorize your expenses. FreshBooks will even remind your clients to pay you. You can skip the awkward follow-up emails. And if that wasn't enough, FreshBooks will even suggest to you quick wins. These are actions that you can take on outstanding invoices and build time that will keep your business running profitably and will get you paid. So with all this, you can imagine how FreshBooks users get paid up to 4 days faster. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to my listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/loveyourwork and enter love your work in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Yeah, it sounds like it's something that you kind of intuitively understood from your own experience, but then obviously you still have to have that curiosity there for, you know, uncovering this pattern and finding those stories and everything. Were there any things based on what you thought before you started writing, based on compared to what you know now, or were there any surprises or things that you were really curious about in the beginning that you had revelations about as you were doing all this research and writing this book?
One of the things that I struggled with, and anytime you write a book and you don't struggle with something that you're talking about, I think that's a good thing. Like, I think you need to be a little bit more honest. And there was a part in the book where I was writing out these principles and going, wait, did I do this? And this is the rule of ownership. So this is in the latter part of the book where I realized that the most successful creative people in the world have typically retained the majority stake in their intellectual property. So George Lucas does this with Star Wars, where when he goes to finance The Empire Strikes Back, he decides that he's going to fund the whole thing himself. It cost $20 million. He basically took every dollar that he made from Star Wars and reinvested it to make the second film instead of taking an investment from Fox, which he did for the first movie, but they owned like almost 70% of the movie. And he flips it. And the second movie, he owns 77%. And he negotiates this ridiculous deal where he owns 90% of the merchandise. And they go, okay, whatever. Because he took the risk and he got the reward. And as we all know, they made billions off of those toys. And, so that's an example. Pixar is another example. John Lasseter goes to work for Disney. Disney fires him. He goes and becomes part of Pixar and really turns it into an animation studio. A few years later, Disney wants to hire him back for triple his salary. He says, no, I'm having way more fun here. And I have ownership here. I have control over the art. So I'm writing this and I'm going, well, I just sold this book to a publisher. Like, I have actually sold ownership of this. I'll get a royalty, but I sold this. And so a lot of these things have they're sort of paradoxes. And so one of the things that I realized with ownership is it's not that you never sell your work off to somebody. It's that you need to do it for the right price and for the right reasons. So it makes sense sometimes for an author to sell his book to a publisher if it means he's going to reach more people and the money he gets is more than enough to sustain himself while and after he's writing. And if he's got some other strategy for the book that, you know, goes beyond getting paid for book sales, which is, you know, my case. And you know, you see this with like Dr. Dre, right? You know, he went through his life doing basically doing a series of bad business deals. And his first, you know, his first band, NWA, they're world famous. They basically usher West Coast hip hop into the world. They say, this is a thing, right? And all these groups and rappers after them, I mean, they set the model. So, you know, Snoop Dogg, Tupac, they all follow NWA. These guys made pennies on the dollar off of their work while the record label and the managers are making bank. They were cheated because they didn't know any better because they were teenagers. And then he goes, starts a record label called Death Row with Suge Knight, who's basically a thug and is like, you know, making business deals with baseball bats. And Dre goes, I'm out of here. This is not a good place to be. Walks away from a 50% in a $20 million company. And it goes through these series of bad business deals, eventually starts Aftermath, signs 50 Cent and Eminem, ends up creating Beats. And, you know, we know the rest of the story where he sells Beats to Apple for $700 million.
I think you're wearing Beats right now, aren't you?
Yeah. I am.
So it just shows you how far it's
right.
How far that took exactly. Him.
Yeah. But I mean, so he did sell it, right? For $700 million. I think it makes sense to give up ownership of your work if somebody else can make it better. I think this was the case for George Lucas. He was done with Star Wars. He said in an interview, what is the point of making more movies if nobody's going to like them, if everybody's just going to criticize you for them, which is what happened with the prequels, right? So he was done. He was burnt out. He had created something and he could only take it so far. And so he gives it over to Disney and says, you guys take it the rest of the way. And Dre, on the other hand, had seen what had happened when you sell out too soon, right? When you give your work away too quickly and somebody is going to take care of you. That's a bad idea. It happens in the music business all the time. And so he really held on to ownership of Beats until it just made absolute sense to partner with Apple, you know, with iTunes and, you know, the number one music distributor in the world and find a way to partner with them where he was still creatively involved, but also, you know, had a really big cash out and became one of the very first billionaire musicians in the world. So that was something that I struggled with. That was surprising to me. The other thing I struggled with is I believe in generosity. I really do. But I found that most starving artists are too generous. They're giving away all their work. They're not valuing their creations. And it turns out that to be a thriving artist, you have to charge something. You have to work for something. You can't be giving away your work all the time. Because if you don't take yourself seriously, nobody else will. And that's something that I still struggle with. I like being generous, but I realize like you have to be intentional. You have to be strategic. If you're giving away your art, it needs to be because you're trying to market yourself, not just because you think someday somebody's going to turn around after years of you giving them stuff for free and say, I'll pay you for this. It doesn't work that way. You can't work. Opportunity is too vague. You need to be giving away samples of your work and chalking it up to marketing. Or the other thing is you just need to be charging a little bit, right? And then over time, you can charge more and more and more. And so the idea of ownership that thriving artists own the majority of their work and starving artists tend to sell out too soon. And this idea that you can't give away your best work for free all the time. You need to always charge something. You need to always work for something. Even if that something is, I'm going to intentionally give this away to this community because I know it's going to return to me in the form of blank, you know, more people or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so tricky, as you mentioned, because, you know, the way that media works right now, or the way that art spreads, is that you, part of the model is you kind of give it away for free. And, you know, I've run into an issue similar about this ownership thing. Recently, I had a chance to join a podcast network, and it was like this big, successful podcast network. And I'm like, wow, this is really my big break. Cool. And you know, I took a couple weeks to think about it, and I really looked over everything. And then I realized, like, wow, this is kind of a shitty deal. Like, this is not, I'm going to have to give up a lot. I mean, like, there's a good potential upside, but who really knows? So I actually ended up turning it down. And, you know, I'm experimenting with things like premium level of the podcast. I'm reaching out to advertisers myself and having more success than I thought that I would have, because, you know, previously maybe I just didn't want to do the ad sales or something like that. And then so it's a trade-off. I know, like, my first book, I often say I don't think I could have possibly written my first book without the publisher, without them putting the money down and even finding me and saying, like, oh, this is a great idea, there should be a book. But now I'm in the middle of writing a book right now that I'm starting to find it difficult to find reasons to try to get a publisher for it. Yeah. So
yeah, I totally get that. And I wrestle with that all the time, every day. And I think if you're doing that, you're okay. I think the person who finds themselves in trouble is going, this one thing, you know, this person signing me, this deal, this opportunity, this is going to be my big break. I love the story. I heard this first from Stephen Pressfield. Story of a new actor moves to town, moves to Hollywood, and is at a party talking to Walter Matthau, who's kind of at the peak of his career at the time. And kid says to Matthau, man, I'm really struggling. And Matthau goes, well, what's going on? And the kid says, well, I'm just waiting for my big break. And Matthau says, kid, it's not the one break. It's the 50 breaks. And I think that's the difference between a starving artist mindset, which is like work, 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 and then maybe someday I'll get lucky, versus the thriving artist who is intentionally making breaks happen, creating opportunities, not selling out too soon or giving up control of their work. Because when you do that, it's okay to sell your work to a publisher or you know, join a podcast network or whatever, so long as you understand what you're giving up and what you're getting in return. But when you say, this is my salvation, as a lot of musicians in Nashville where I live tend to do, if I could just get the record label to sign me, that would be great.
I could just get picked. You're waiting to be picked. You're waiting for permission to do a thing that you don't need permission to do.
That you already have all the resources to do yourself, but there is fear and there's self-doubt that says, well, you can't do this. And they must know more than you. And the more I work with these institutions, publishers, record labels, the more I see they know just as much as you. They have the same internet that you do. They can hire the same college interns that you know. And it's not this like elite class of experts anymore. Are there still good people in the publishing industry who know a ton? Absolutely. But if you're going to do that, be sure that you work with those people. The idea that the institution, the system is going to take care of you, that will cause you to starve. And you need to realize that you alone are in charge of your own success. And the deals that you make, the opportunities that you chase, all of these are moving you in the direction of that success, or they're moving you away from it.
I was speaking with Seth Godin a few weeks ago for the podcast, and he said something that really flipped a switch in me, which is he had a bookshelf behind him, kind of like you do right now. And he motioned to the bookshelf behind him. He's like, all these books here, they're all bestsellers. Every single one was a surprise. If publishers knew what was going to be a bestseller, they would just pick the bestsellers.
That's right. They don't know.
I mean, I think there is a lot of like, I tried to write a proposal for the book that I'm writing now. I mean, it was totally different. Now, if I go back and look at that proposal, I realize publishers really know a lot about positioning a book and making it a saleable book. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I've learned some of that stuff, but I just can't muster the will to write a book proposal, I think, is the thing, because it just seems like wasted energy I mean, it's useful because you do get to think about marketing and positioning and stuff like that. But then you're doing all this writing that isn't part of the final product, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Yep.
I mean, all of your books have been with publishers, haven't they?
The first book was self-published.
Oh, okay.
It did really well. And every book I write, I think, should I self-publish this or traditionally publish? And I go back and forth. And I think it has to be the right book, the right publisher, the right partnership. But I will say early on, there was this luster of working with a publisher. I got picked. I felt special. And the more I've done this, the more aggressive I've gotten, the more I've negotiated better deals and retained rights to certain things. And at the end of the day, I assume that they don't have my best interest in mind. They have their best interest in mind, which is what they should have in mind. And I need to have my best interest in mind. And so I don't just look at a contract and go, okay, I'm gonna sign this. I go, what do I absolutely want out of this? And even when I do a book deal, I'm still taking full responsibility for the book. I talked to an author who has sold 500,000 books and very successful, big author who's just getting bigger every day. And you always assume that somebody like knows something that you don't know, or they're doing something that you're not doing, or they got a better deal, right? Or the better publisher or whatever. So I'm talking to this person, I go, hey, how do you like working with that publisher, right? And he goes, well, I like that they pay me. That was it. That was the most he could say about this, you know, major publisher that I just assumed was doing all kinds of things for him. I like that they pay me. So, you know, if they pay you enough, it makes sense. But beyond that, you know, not necessarily. And Seth is right. You know, if they knew, if they knew what was going to sell, they would just sign those books. They don't. They sign 20 books, knowing 19 are going to fail, and hoping one is a great bestseller.
And one path I'm considering right now is actually I'm already getting paid to write the book because I'm sending it out in emails each chapter a day for 30 days. Mm-hmm. And so I'm already getting paid because some people are paying me and some people are donating and stuff. Wow. And I might try like what Nir Eyal did, which is he wrote Hooked, and mm-hmm. he basically did all blog posts and then self-published. And then mm-hmm. once it was self-published, it sold well enough that then he went and got a book deal for the hardcover.
Yeah, makes sense.
I mean, he didn't have to write a proposal, so that's like the most appealing part to me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, do you have to write a proposal for Great Artists Don't Starve? Or sorry,
yeah,
Real Artists Don't Starve.
Yeah. I mean, but for me, a proposal is an outline.
Yeah,
it's an outline in the first chapter, so it's useful. You know,
that's true.
All the other stuff, like you know, hey, here's my platform and all that crap. Not as useful when you're writing your third, fourth, or fifth book. But every time I write a book, I've got to write a proposal and say, you know, here's what this is worth to me, and here's why it's worth that to me. And I know every time I write a book, I can go self-publish it because I've done it before, and I've had a successfully self-published book. So when I go to publisher, I'm going, what are you going to pay for? What are you going to bring to the table? And why are these things I can't do myself?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great age to think about that. When I talk to writers who are thinking about publishing, they go, should I self-publish or traditionally publish? I go, well, how many traditional publishers are knocking on your door right now? If the answer is none, then it's not really a choice. You need to go self-publish. And I think that's a great first step.
Traditionally publish in that, and I think that this is all relevant to the larger idea of do you work with a bigger entity or not, is that if they aren't knocking on your door, then what leverage do you have? Exactly. Instead, there's so many things you can do that where you have so much leverage that they're clamoring mm-hmm. to work with you. And you have the freedom to walk away.
That's right. Yeah. And I always have that freedom, which, like, as you said, gives me leverage versus going, oh, I'll do whatever you say. Those deals never really end up working out too well because mm-hmm. you've got a lot of hope in them and you're doing, you know, whatever they want, and they've got leverage, and that's not a good place to be. You know, we've heard this before. You don't get what you deserve. You get what you negotiate. And in order to negotiate, you've got to be able to have something to bring to the table. I heard Seth say one time, we used to have to chase publishers to publish books. Now we need to stop chasing publishers and start chasing readers. Because what do publishers want? They want the readers. And if you go, I've got the readers, now you get to choose, right? That's the hardest part, is getting the readers. Now you get to choose whether or not you want to do this yourself, which is pretty easy these days, or partner with the publisher to try to reach more people, or, you know, sell your book for the right price point. But the question is not, do I publish this thing or not? The question is there a demand for it? Do I have readers? If not, that's where you need to start. Build the audience.
Yeah. And I think people in any creative field can often fantasize or imagine that, oh, to become a filmmaker, they've got to make a big deal for a feature film. To become a writer, they have to get a book deal. To become a musician, they have to get a record deal. And all those things are so far removed from what step one looks like, which is to actually... in some small form, do that work.
Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. And I believe that all art needs an audience. And it turns out this is something that all great artists do, is in one form or another, they're building their audience by sharing their work, putting it out there. I love the story of Pablo Picasso marching across town every day to paint Gertrude Stein. And he did this reputedly about 100 times. Why did he do this? Well, because she was the connector. She was the patron. She was the person who was holding weekly salons at her house on the left bank in Paris, having all these artists and art patrons and people over in her house, introducing everybody. So that's the person to connect with. And Picasso gets this. And so what does he do? He goes, I'm going to put my art in front of the person who can help it spread. And these people, these patrons, are people all around us today. They're people like you, David. They're podcasters and bloggers and people with Etsy shops and big Instagram accounts and people on Facebook. So there's not like an elite few who hold all the attention. There are millions of influencers, depending on what the niche is that you want to reach. You just have to connect with these people, and it's not that hard. You've got to have good work, and you've got to be able to share it. And the artists who do this succeed, and those who don't, who've got their novel in their drawer, who have that brilliant idea in the back of their head, they get the attention they deserve, which is none. Mm-hmm. You've got to put it out there.
And as an author, I always – one of the things that impresses me so much about the book is that is the stories – just like amazing, great, appropriate stories that I haven't necessarily heard anywhere else.
Thanks.
How do you have a system for collecting those and organizing them and having them available when the time comes?
I got a good tip from my friend Derek Halpern years ago.
Oh yeah.
And I said, he reads a lot, and he only reads hard copy books. Like, he doesn't read digital. He reads a book like five times.
I can tell you that it's not true.
Well, that's what he says.
I went to Barbados with him once. I mean, not just him and I.
Yeah,
he had a Kindle, getaway. But yeah, he does read a lot of.
So I only read hard.
Sorry, anyway. I ruined your story. You're welcome.
I said, how do you find new books to read? He says, I read the bibliography. And I was like, I've never thought to do that.
Oh, yes.
So he reads the bibliographies of his favorite books. So I started doing that. So typically when I'm doing research for a book, and I'm almost always working on a book, I start with an idea. This, for me, it was the Michelangelo article. So the next step was, how do I find out more about this guy, Rab Hatfield? He wrote a book. I've got it right here. He wrote a book called The Wealth of Michelangelo.
It was hard to find it. I saw that in your bibliography notes.
It was super hard to find. And I paid $100
for it. It's not on Kindle?
It was, I mean, it's like an academic book, you know, there was like 800 of them printed and it's out of print. I had to go to some old library site that resells old library books. And I found it. And I read it. And then I read a bunch of Michelangelo biographies. And then I started reading bibliographies of those books. And I just, you know, like, it's just this thread. And so when I write a book, I'm doing that. And I'm also reading contemporary stuff about the subject. So this is a book about creativity and business, basically. So I'm reading, you know, Daniel Pink's book, A Whole New Mind. And I'm reading Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's book about creativity. Like, I'm reading all the modern books that have been written in the past 10, 20 years about the subject. Then I'm reading what they're reading. And I'm asking myself, is there an argument that I could make here that hasn't been made before? Because if there is, then I don't need to make it. But if not, if there's a gap where I can kind of fill, then I write the book, and I will go to Amazon and I will like search a book, and then I'll look at the suggested books and I'll like buy all those books. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bought hundreds of books for the writing of this book, and I threw out probably a third of them, and I read them, you know, or skimmed through them. And I said, oh, this isn't work. This is going to work. This isn't going to work. But typically, you know, one book leads to another and so on.
And then when you actually find one of the stories though, do you have a capture system for that? Or you just put a sticky note in there, or how does that work?
I don't, you know, Ryan Holiday is really good at this. He's got a whole note card system. I was like, oh, that's good. I wish I were that organized. I think it's Hemingway who said this, that you read a book, and if it's good enough, you'll remember it. Mm-hmm. I think that was his quote. That's sort of my system. I read a lot, and if a book is really good, I will read it again. And the story that jumps out at me is the story that jumps out at me. And I buy the book on Kindle so that I can search the Kindle and find the story again. So no sticky notes. I read a bunch of books. I'm always reading. And what I'm looking for is light bulbs. So the Michelangelo story is a light bulb. I go, that's interesting. And it turns out I've just been reading a bunch of books about artists and authors because I'm fascinated with that. And immediately I'm thinking, oh, this is true for Van Gogh, and this is true for Picasso, and mm-hmm. this is true for this person, and Jim Henson, and this, and this. And I'm just reading all the time. And then something sparks an insight, and then I kind of pull everything together and basically go back and read those books that I'm already familiar with. So when I start writing a book, David, 50% of the research is already done accidentally. Like, I'm always reading. And then I don't know if this happens too, but when I start writing, I start thinking about stuff and I go, oh, that reminds me of such and such. And I'll just go back and I'll pull that story in. It's not a very neat way, you know, it's not a very like clean way to write a book, but it's the only way I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried the Ryan Holiday method myself with the index cards and stuff, but I tend to be a little minimalist since I live in a different country and all that stuff. Right. But I did find one thing I'm also forced to buy Kindle books pretty much because English language books are very difficult to come by where I'm at, which I groaned about at first, but then I realized I started color coding my highlights. So if I see a story that I think fits a theme that I might want to write about someday, then I highlight that blue. And mm-hmm. I didn't even realize until I started writing the book that I'm writing now a lot of this research is kind of already done. I just need to open the Kindle app and search around and find the right passages if I need to check facts and stuff, if it's not the stuff that's just in my brain.
Yeah, it's good. Typically, I'm pulling stories, as you said, and so I will read a book, I will internalize a story, I will remember it, I will go back, I will retell the story, and then I'll pull up the source for like a quote or something, but I'm retelling the story, so I don't need to know it word for word. I'm just getting the gist of it and then fact-checking it to make sure you know, it's accurate.
Oh, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for letting me, pick your brain as an author as well. In addition to talking about the book, Real Artists Don't Starve, which is fantastic. Definitely check it out. Do you have a final message to sum up our conversation today?
I think the thing that I try to sort of distill the message of the book down to, and I write a book to distill a message, I think it was Ryan, who told me, he goes, you know, people go like, what is the message of your book in two sentences? He's like, the point of writing a book is like, you write a book because this is like the simplest way to say the thing that you knew how to say. So it takes 200 pages to say it. You know, so that's the simplest you can say it. I thought that was funny, but I can say mine in a sentence. I wrote this book because I see so many people struggling. They're very talented. They're very skilled. They're struggling to get paid or get attention around their art. And they're missing something. And telling themselves the story of the starving artist, you have to starve, you have to struggle, is not helpful. It's hurting their art. It's hurting their best creative work. And so I wrote this book to offer hope, a challenge. Like, if you're a real artist, then don't starve. You don't have to starve. I believe, and here's the one sentence, that being a starving artist today is a choice, not a necessary condition of doing creative work. So whether or not you starve is up to you.
Great. And where would you like people to go to find more of you?
To learn more about the book, go to don'tstarve.com. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. And if you go to don'tstarve.com, there's some bonuses there where if you order the book, you can, you know, just fill out a little form and get some free stuff as well. And that's don'tstarve.com.
Great. Thanks so much for coming, Jeff. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me, David.
I hope that conversation with Jeff Goines helps you muster the will to make your work real and to get paid for it. For more on taking action to make your art, listen to Seth Godin on episode 77.
You know, you're showing up every day doing a podcast. It's an extraordinarily generous act. There's not a short line between here and success. There is a long line and you're on it, but you're learning every time you do it. How much does it cost you to start doing a podcast? Nothing. Right? But there's all these other people who are waiting for Podcasting Central to call them on the phone and say, will you please do a podcast? And no one's going to call.
Again, Seth is on episode 77. Or listen to Adrian Holovaty's story of keeping ownership over his business. He sold a business, watched it get dismantled, and now he's staying independent.
And you have to care about it.
And how can you work that hard if it's not something you care about?
Right.
And then bring along with that, well, if you care about it so much,
why do you want to get rid of it someday and flip it?
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Adrian is on episode 6. And if you appreciate all the work that goes into making this show, you can help support it. One way is to subscribe, whether it's on Apple Podcasts or Overcast or wherever you get your podcasts. Just hit the subscribe button. Another is to rate the show. On Overcast, it's really easy. Just tap the star icon on this episode. On Apple Podcasts, just go to katavi.net/apple, click on write a review, and click on the star rating. And you don't even have to write a review. It just takes a couple of seconds. You can also join Love Your Work Premium. You'll get access to episodes before everyone else. You can even get ad-free interviews weeks in advance. And you can get your name or business mentioned in the credits of the show. For details, go to katavi.net/premium. That's katavi.net/premium. Love Your Work is brought to you by top Love Your Work Premium members, such as Arif Akhtar. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for the show is More Streets, performed by Spiderflower. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi, Inc.